to the Seamus Heaney Centre podcast. I'm Rachel Brown. In this episode, we hear from former Seamus Heaney Centre fellow, the writer Lucy Caldwell, in a Q&A with our director, Glenn Patterson. This recording captures the Q&A session following an intensive online masterclass on form with Lucy and our students during the lockdown of spring 2020.
That was great. Thank you so much. I would be really interested to know about the very, very early steps as a writer. I know you were saying that you were writing from a very, very early age, but you did do an MA at Goldsmiths those days and weeks immediately after. What were your first steps as a writer?
Well, technically, I was enrolled on the fast track program to be a diplomat with the civil service, which my parents, they'd been happy enough for me to do the MA, but thought that I should have another plan. And so I had applied for the civil service program purely because it was an 18-month application process, and you had to keep going. You had to keep doing things. I had to keep going and doing, like, you know, a test or a maths test, and for some reason I kept on passing them, even the mathsy ones. And then I got to sort of the final stage of this, where they send you away on a residential weekend for to talk to other people, and you do all that sort of team building and all that sort of stuff. And I think I would have loved it, because some of the things I remember, someone once telling me, one of the things that you have to do, you need to get hold of someone's passport and their passport details, and you're in a bar and you need to, you know, and they say sort of, how do you do it? And I love that sort of thing, and I know exactly how I would do it and whatever. But the evening before I was due to go away on this, I just thought, if I do this, that's the direction that my life will take, and I need to give writing a go first, because inevitably if I have something that I really love doing and that's sort of all consuming like that, I won't write, at least not at this period that I need to be. And so instead of doing that, I went back to waitressing, various waitressing jobs, and like bits and pieces of, I used to review books for a true crime magazine and write articles for a true crime magazine under various pseudonyms, because they said that they'd had problems in the past with readers, you know, getting sort of variously attached to correspondence, and so they used to give me a different pseudonym for every article. So I did a lot of patchwork stuff like that instead, to just try to create the space for writing, because I think you're at that stage where the MA is so intense and you're taking in so much, and you're hopefully, you have tutors who are really encouraging, and you've had this. What I think is really important is to establish your writing practice in the world going forth, when you don't have the bubble of those weekly meetings and those supervisions and those writing sessions. And so I think it's really important to sort of put in place, so much of writing is just about the making the space to do it and the routine of it. And so it's setting up those practices, and mine have changed over the years as my circumstances have changed. But it's about putting those things in place so that you have your weekly writers group meeting, which I had. I was one of a group for years, for about 4 or 5 years. We called ourselves a doghouse group because we met in a pub called the Doghouse, and it sort of seemed suitably demonstrative of the status we all kind of felt at that time as wannabe writers. And so having things like that in place, so, you know, that was what I did on a Monday night, and I would get up and I would write before I did any of the other work. You have to just work out ways of protecting your writing time, and it's so hard, you know, and I've had to learn how to do it with breastfeeding babies and with young children about, and with the demands of other jobs. And I think that's the most important thing when you're preparing to leave the bubble of the MA. Don't do anything too interesting. Prolong your return to the rhythms of the real world as long as you can, until you've got this writing time protected.
And you were from the very beginning, your first play, your first full-length play, and your first novel came out, or staged, produced and published in the same year, within a very few months of one another. And I know you've said in the past that you were kind of blithely writing both at that stage. I mean, how did that happen? It's quite unusual for novelists to be writing plays as well, or at least to be doing it as regularly as you were, certainly at that stage.
I don't know. I just did it until I started getting self-conscious because people kept on asking me, which are you really?
Forget I said that.
No, actually, you know what? I actually found it. I always just think that the clearest way of thinking about being a writer, sometimes the hardest thing, especially when you're on this master's program, whatever it is calling yourself a writer. But it's very, very easy. Being a writer has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with whether or not you're published, with whether or not you've won awards, with how many sales figures you have. You're a writer because your primary mode of being in the world is to understand, is to distill. And what am I doing? I'm doing a crucible to sort of, you know, understand the world through, kind of bizarrely, through setting yourself apart from it and through filtering and distilling and giving word to it. And so if that is what you have to do to be in this world and to be most fully in this world, you are a writer, and a writer is someone who writes. So it took me a long time to, I used to be so shy of saying that I was a writer. I feel so self-conscious. And so in a way it was quite easy, because if I was with a group of novelists, I'd sort of say, well, you know, yes, I've written a novel, but I'm really a playwright, and sort of vice versa. And that's something that I think another piece of really useful advice that I didn't learn early enough is, when you're on an MA and people are, you know, people, well-meaning partners or family members or friends or loved ones, when they ask what you're writing, they don't actually want to know. All they want to know is they want to genuinely, with a kind of feeling of relief, be able to say, that sounds brilliant. So what you need to do, I think, is come up with, this isn't the elevator pitch, although it is sort of a version of that, come up with a really brilliant sounding sort of carapace, sort of armor for the thing that you are working on. When someone who doesn't know anything about the world of books says, what are you working on? You can tell them this one or two sentences, and they can say genuinely and with relief, yeah, that sounds really brilliant. Because I think too often I would be the person that, you know, talked faster and faster, explaining the intricate nuances of the brilliant plot device of my novel, whilst it evaporated to smoke before me. And like the person who's, I was pinning against the wall to tell this. You know, so that's the other thing that you want to do. You want to let yourself carry on being a writer. Let yourself try various forms. Don't let other people pin you down, and have the thing that you can offer to people. Because there's that thing as well where, when, you know, once people ask me if I'm a novelist or a playwright, I suddenly feel fraudulent in both, and suddenly I'm neither. You know, in the same way that if you start trying to explain what you're working on too early, it turns to dust, you know, or it turns to smoke, or it sort of dies, or you hear the words aloud and you lose confidence in it. And so that's a very sort of roundabout way of answering your question, but I think it's sort of, you know, protect the work, protect that bit of yourself.
I mean, I think that for a very, very long time, I was afraid to do anything else, because the experience of writing my first novel was so draining and demanding. I hadn't expected, I thought I knew I could have done a couple of lines about what it was, but when it came to writing it, it just seemed to take everything. And when I was asked, as inevitably writers are, there are people who are very keen to see someone publish for the first time and will, you know, offer you the opportunity to do something, maybe try writing something for stage, something for radio, writing for newspapers. I would say no to everything, because I was so worried that I wouldn't actually have enough for the next novel, or I wouldn't have the resources for it. And it's a matter of some regret now that, you know, after 3 decades of, you know, I have latterly started doing other things and have really, really enjoyed them. So I wish that I had said yes.
If you're exhausted from writing a novel, you know, the challenges of a play, I love talking to people about the preciseness, the sort of possibilities of their craft. Like, I love talking to a lighting designer and saying, I need this mood. And they can say, okay, well, if you want a dawn light, we do this and we do this. And that casts a whole kind of stark, you know, atmosphere over everything that you write. So you can write something with quite a lightness of touch in the knowledge that with the right lighting, mm-hmm. it's going to be really, you know. So I love that collaborative nature of, say, playwriting. I find that with short stories, especially over the last few years of having very young children, I just haven't had the capacity for novel. You know, novel, I think you need to slog away at every day. A novel, almost like a sort of iCloud storage, you can't contain the whole thing in you. You know, you're sort of outsourcing it and you have to come back each day and you have to pull bits down and you have to. But with a short story, what I found is that over the last few years, when I've only had, you know, two mornings to work in or bits of nap time, I found that I have been able to hold in me or hold myself open enough for a short story. You know, something about the tension of it. And so you'll find different forms give you different things, and working within the limitations and possibilities of that form are what's really exciting and can bring all sorts of new energy if you're feeling creatively exhausted by something. So I would say to all of you, definitely do what Glenn didn't, and, you know, try different things, and don't worry about being. I always used to worry that by doing more than one, I always used to think that if I only wrote in one form, I could get really good at that form, and that if I continued sort of trying lots of different things, I'd end up being no good at either. Maybe the case, but there's something, it's kept me energized and it's kept me working at times when I couldn't have written novels back to back to be working on other things. The one thing that I found I couldn't do actually is journalism. I write occasional bits of journalism, but I found that I had a weekly column for a while in The Independent just after my first novel was published, and it was 500 words and I did it for sort of just under a year. And for the first few weeks it was fine, it was really fun. Started getting a bit harder after that. You know, after the first few months, I started really not having enough to say. I didn't really like talking about myself. I didn't really like talking about sort of politics. And so sort of spinning something interesting and, you know, witty or meaningful, what I found I started doing is I started skimming things off the surface of my life that if I had let them sort of, you know, bed down, might have become the stuff of fiction, you know, might have become a pearl or something. And instead I was desperately sort of using up everything that I had, everything that I encountered in the course of a week for the purpose of this 500 word column. And so I stopped doing that because I could feel that. And in a way, the muscles as well, you know, writing journalism, it used the same muscles in a way that for me, say, teaching didn't. That I felt energized in a different way from, you know, teaching and reading and reading work with other writers and with students and editing other people's work. I found that balance worked for me in a way that journalism didn't. But then again, there are a lot of writers who their mainstay is journalism.
Another practical question. You know, you were talking about the support, the group that you met with in the doghouse. And I always think that it's helpful and sometimes essential to have at least one relationship, not personal relationship, but a relationship in publishing or with your writing that you can depend on, because much changes, publishers change hands, people move jobs. What about, you know, the first steps, editors, agents? Could you say a little bit just about your experience of that especially in the early days?
Yeah, I think that you'll know already from your course, you know, there's a few people who sort of get your work. And in my doghouse group, what you're doing in a writing group, what you're doing in a workshop situation is you're honing your own instincts. and you're working on your, like a horse, like a cart horse, you're working on your blinkers. You know, sometimes you just need those blinkers on and you just need to keep on plodding on. And it doesn't matter, you know, if anyone's trying to distract you, you just need to keep on, because you're the only one that knows. And but what you're doing in a workshop or in a writing group situation is those ways of learning to see how other people read your work. And in that writing group of mine, there was one person whose opinions I grew always to trust, because I knew that he just understood my work. He understood what I was trying to do. And so if he queried something or if he liked something, I could trust that. There was one other person who I really liked personally. Everything he said, I would just in one ear, out the other. I wouldn't pay any attention to it, because I just knew that however well-meaning it might be, sometimes it was just so irrelevant to what I was doing that it was just, there was no point listening to it. And as well, it's that thing where with your writing group, what you want to do is you can feel when you submit a piece of work to university workshop or to your own little group, so buffeted by so many people. And quite often people will say something because they want to have something to say, or they will get carried away in their own saying of it and start convincing themselves of it, which can be very convincing to you as the writer. But what you always need to do is you need to, what I always think is, trust that after a situation like that, the important things will have gone in and they will stay. Don't rush off immediately and try to make notes. Don't try to do any sort of surgery on your piece while it's still raw. Let it put aside your work for a few days or for a week, and then go back to it and trust that your subconscious will have taken in what it needs to take in. So I think that's very important. I think as well, on the question of agents, I was talking with an unpublished writer at the weekend. I was helping her with her novel in progress, and she had signed with an agent. She'd won a couple of competitions, signed with an agent. An agent had suggested she didn't publish her first book. An agent had given her advice that she felt was wrong, that I felt was wrong for her work in progress. And I had to remind her, when you're unpublished, it seems as if, you know, the agents, they're the gatekeepers. You know, you need them. What you have to remember is the power dynamic of that situation. They work for you. They are your advocate. They are your representative. You give them instruction. You say, I want this to happen. Can you make it happen? You know, I want to be with this publishing house. I want to. So it's always useful to remember that, and to remember that when you're meeting an agent, you need to choose someone that you think is going to be a good advocate for your work, someone who will understand your work, someone who is going to be helpful of you as a writer. And it can be possible, I think, for that power dynamic to be skewed so that you can feel, it's possible to feel grateful for any attention that you have, for any advice that you have. And just keep that little thing inside you saying, you know, this is you're the one in control here. You work for me. I have quite a scary agent. He was a model for the kind of villain in Bridget Jones's Diary. And so it's always, I always kind of remind myself before I meet with him, we sort of have lunch, and I always remind myself, you know, lunch is on you, you work for me.
you reminded me of Carlo Gabler, a great friend, such a good writer, and I remember him saying at some early stage in our friendship that he was changing agents, and he took a table somewhere and invited agents to come to be interviewed by him, which was, you can do that. But it is important, and I know you've got a very good relationship at Faber with your editor. Again, is that you can't guarantee that that's going to be the case, that somebody's going to stay there, but how important has that been for you over the last few years?
First novel was published by Penguin, by Viking, very lovely, nice editor. But I had, you know, they're such a huge corporation, and even bigger now since they've merged with Random House than they were then. And, you know, in terms of editorial help, I had an email with two paragraphs of thoughts, like that was it. And my first novel is pretty much, you know, and I would go in there and I would just feel so out of place and so tiny and so insignificant. And then Penguin, I'd signed a one book deal, but they said they wanted to know the outline of what I was writing next. They sort of wanted first option on a first dibs, and then they decided they weren't interested. You know, screw you, Penguin, I got your little colophon in the back of my book. That's what I'd wanted ever since being in the Puffin Club. But so then I sort of started looking at, and this is the best advice if you're trying to find an agent, I think. Look at the acknowledgements of books and find a writer whose work you think is similar to yours or not dissimilar to yours, or a writer who you really like or a writer who you respect, and contact that agent and say to them, I'm writing to you because, you know, they it's really good if they can feel that you're not just sort of blindly submitting, that you've chosen them for a reason. And if they do represent the sort of work that you think your work is like, or you'd like your books to be like, probably there's already an affinity there. And so similarly, I started thinking about who I'd really like to be published by. And my plays were published by Faber at the time. And I'd loved the fact that Faber was small enough. I mean, Faber's quite big as indies go, but I'd love the fact that when I walked into the Faber offices to meet my drama editor there, everyone knew each other. Everyone had read what was going on. There was a sense that everyone was invested in the books that they were producing. And so I really thought I wanted to be with Faber. And there was one editor, Angus, who turned out to be my editor, who he edited Sebastian Barry, Claire Kilroy, Claire Keegan. He had done the Faber book, you know, the New Irish Short Stories, or David Marcus's series that I edited last year. So he had this brilliant Irish list. And he also edited, he edits Ish, Kizzy Ishiguri, he edits, you know. And so I thought he would be a good fit for me. And so I said this to Peter, and I said, I'd like my work to be sent to him. And then he took me on then for my second novel. And yeah, we've worked together for 10 years, which is quite rare in publishing terms, but it really means that we have such a good working relationship now, because I can trust that he knows what I'm trying to do, and he can push me in interesting directions as well. You know, he manages Faber's crime list, and he always thought that I would write good noir. And so he got me writing sort of my first noir-y type stories. And even though they're not very full-out noir, it was a really useful, interesting and good sort of tone, or good thing to sort of animate some of my work. And so a good editor will be working with you in that sort of way as well. And it's funny, I think that the publishing, probably as well, Glenn, from when you started publishing, the thing was, you wanted to be with a big press. You know, you wanted to be with one of the sort of, you know, big whatever, big five or big however many. And I think that's really changed. And the friends that I do see that are having the best relationships in publishing are with smaller publishers, you know, like Head of Zeus or Arcadia or No Alibis Press or Tramp or Banshee, or the smaller presses where when they do take on your work, everyone is really committed to it. And they're not just doing the thing that big publishers do, where, you know, they're publishing a couple of hundred books that year and most don't get the marketing budget, one or two do, and they just let the others sink or swim, which is what happened to my first book. It had a very small print run, almost no coverage, went out of print almost immediately. And so it's an interesting thing that that were I starting out now, I would be much more inclined to want to go with a small press rather than going for one of the big ones, which wasn't the case when I did start.
I remember getting something actually when I was at Penguin, as I was for a while, and getting response from my editor to one book, to the manuscript, saying there's nothing in this I would change. And I was thinking, well, how can you not want to change anything, because there's loads in it that I want to change? So I just felt that the role of the editor at that stage was changing and was becoming very focused on the selling rather than on the book. I'm conscious, I can see your clock behind you, and I know that you have limited writing time in a day, and I'm loath to take up too much more of it. I just come back to, because you've been writing short stories, Multitudes, first collection, and then you have finished this collection, Intimacies, which, because of everything that's happened and the fact that there are no bookshops open and no festivals, is going to be published next year, but it was ready to be published. But that's a run of quite sustained time, productivity with short stories. Could you just say a little bit about that? Because they're quite similar books in that they have the same number of stories in each one. There's a real scheme there, which is characteristic of your work.
Yeah, they're sister volumes. And I liked, when I was writing, it's funny because, again, you know, going back to the, are you a novelist, are you a playwright thing? I think with Multitudes, it could, none of the narrators or characters have names in either collection. And with each collection, they could almost have been published a bit like that David Shalloy was. I mean, that was published as a novel, shortlisted for the Booker. It's not a novel. It's a collection of short stories, very loosely linked. You know, each of those volumes could have been published as a sort of almost as a cubist portrait of growing up. I'm always interested in form. And I'm interested in, with a short story collection, a collection of short stories, not just being the short stories that happen to have been written over a certain period or happen to be put together, but something very, very tightly, very thematically linked. And I saw both of the collections as like an album. I think it's when I sat in the pub for ages with Multitudes, working at like the running order and working at which were A side and which were B side, and you know, what you want is your opening track on the beat. Like, we worked out all of it like that because we wanted each to feel like a tight and unified thing.
And just a very final question. I'm reminded just listening to you there talking and the examples that you gave of the stories that you gave in the handout, but also as you alluded to your own work and what you've done with the short story. I mean, you are an extraordinarily innovative and daring writer. You do set yourself challenges almost in every single thing that you write is setting yourself a new challenge. Do you ever scare yourself?
Do you know what? I'm not very good at metaphor. I'm going to get like my writer's membership card taken away from you for me. You know, I'm really, really bad at that, at figurative writing, at metaphor, simile, at coming up with, you know, I'm not very good at, I read some writers, a friend of mine, she wrote a novel set in the Weimar Republic. And it's so like, it's like really long historical novel, absolutely packed with detail. And I just keep like, my mind boggles at the thought that someone can sit and invent all of that. I know that what I can do is, this is the thing as well that might be interesting for people to know, you know, we undervalue so much the things that come naturally. We think that they're not worth anything because they do come naturally. And, you know, my first novel is first person present tense, 6-year-old girl, 16-year-old girl. And it's much more akin to, say, a monologue. So I didn't see there was much difference because I'm doing voices, I'm ventriloquizing. And it took me years to write my second novel because I thought that to be a proper writer, you had to do third person past tense. You know, you had to sort of be a bit like Dickens-y and or a bit, you know, George Eliot-y or whatever. And no one told me that, you know, you don't have to. You can carry on writing 6-year-olds in the present tense for your whole writing life if you want to. So I think that for me, actually, it's been a case not of the most useful lessons have been not those in which I've sought to stretch and test myself in those ways, but the ways in which I've come to have confidence and not undervalue what I do naturally. And when I sort of found that with Multitudes, I think when I found a way of writing, you know, my writing style is quite, it's very rhythmically precise, but it's quite simple. And when I found a way of writing those stories in that way, and I'm not caring, that was when things really started coming alive for me. But yeah, I think I'm always in that same way that it doesn't matter if you write the same book twice. Maybe you like, you look at someone like William Maxwell, who was New Yorker's fiction editor and a very fine writer himself, and you read his first novel and his last novel, and they're exactly the same. And it's the trauma of being a young boy and his mother dying in the Spanish flu pandemic, and this when he was 6 or something. And both novels are exactly the same in content, but it's interesting to read them side by side because you see how a writer throughout his writing life and with the benefit of his editing life writes the same story completely differently. And so it's that tension between not fearing returning to what those stories or those psychic wounds, whatever way you see writing might be. And if I'm always kind of a bit restless and impatient to be trying something new and to be pushing myself as well. It's a funny tension.
At this point, we open the floor to student questions, including how can you tell if your story is to become a novel, a play, or a short story?
Yeah, really good question. I always go with my instinct, and I'm rarely wrong. And if I am wrong, I turn it into a radio play. I think that whatever you're writing, it's being in control of. Yeah, don't tell the BBC that, they're a load of my bread and butter. I think that being in control of that form is really, really crucial. And I think there's a play is more often the voices chattering in my head to each other, and I listen, and so I don't know. It's something that I've always done. I've always done on instinct. So I think with a short story, sometimes I will start with a wisp of something. Like, it might be almost nothing. It might be just a mood or a fragment or a glint or a something almost nothing. One line on a page. Go see where you go. Like with a novel, the atmosphere that you can create, the time that you have, a novel as a medium is a medium best suited to time, and you can seed things in for a much later payback. With a play, it never matters what you're writing in terms of the characters' words. If you spend too much time giving them beautifully turned sentences, it's completely dead. You're always writing what they're doing and what they're doing to each other. And there's that thing that sometimes we do things and we know what we're doing, and sometimes we do things and we don't know what we're doing, or we fool ourselves and tell ourselves we're doing something honourable, whether it's dishonourable or vice versa. And so as a playwright, that's what you're writing. You're writing the action, and you're writing what's going on underneath, and it sort of doesn't matter what the characters are saying. Mm. And with a novel, the way that it's told does really matter. So I suppose, formally speaking, that would be the sort of most useful books that I could give.
Our students continued to grill Lucy for a while on practical matters, such as where to submit work, and continued the discussion on some of the works highlighted earlier during the masterclass.
Thanks a million. That was absolutely wonderful. Thank you. And sorry you couldn't be in Belfast, thank you for joining us this morning. And thanks, everybody, for joining in and being there. And I'm sure you got a huge amount out of that. And we'll all get together again sometime soon.
The Seamus Heaney Centre podcast is created in a small back room, and during these times of quarantine, in a series of small back rooms, by Ian Sansom, Stephen Sexton and Rachel Brown. With thanks, as always, to our guests, to producer Chantal Aylesby, and to Nick Boyle for his music. Special thanks to the Queen's Annual Fund.